Today is Monday, May 14th, 2007, and I'm with Joe Graythorne, a.k.a. Bingo, and we're in Duncan.
We're in Maple Bay.
We're in Maple Bay. And my name is Jessica Wood, and this is an interview for the RUSI UVic Oral History, Military Oral History Project.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So you were saying, thank you for coming. Thank you for having me out today. What was the website that you were just mentioning?
It's www.powwowtrail.com.
Okay.
And you go all, scroll all the way to the bottom. There's a little box. You just type in Joe Graythorne. And it brings up more than one thing that I've been affiliated with.
Mm-hmm.
I consider myself still to be the president of the Nava group, the Vancouver Island Nava group.
Okay.
A little bit of conflict, but that's going to be straightened out once the national president gets here.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll be coming here because we're doing a variety of veteran stories.
Okay. Now, just so I can cover some of the background information, you served in Vietnam?
Yes, I did. I was with the 3rd Marine Air Wing.
And you're from here? You're from Cowichan?
I'm Cowichan and New Chelmsford. I'm proud of both.
Oh.
My father was New Chelmsford. My mother was Cowichan. I served on council for DTDOT First Nation for about 8-9 years. Same with the New Chelmsford Tribal Council for as many years.
Your father's DTDOT?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Oscar Edward Gray. He was actually drafted right from Port Renfrew for
really?
World War II.
And he was Army?
He was Army. He was Army Commando. My brother Glenn Gray was taken a year after I was, and he spent his time in the Army as well with the Green Beret Special Forces. My brother Buddy Gray was taken into the Army, and he started out as a tanker driving tanks, then he went on to become a cannon cocker. Loads the 105s and go boom. I don't know what the real title is. I just call him a cannon cocker.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I spent time in the United States Marine Corps. I thought I was going to finish high school. I got as far as homeroom in 1969, and this big burly black guy walked in and he pointed at 3 of us, and we were taken to the AFI Center at 5 in the morning. And the rest is history. I never made it home for supper.
And where was this?
This was in Seattle, Washington.
In Seattle?
Yeah, I was going. I wanted to finish high school in America.
That'll learn you.
I wanted to experience new things, and I did. I did.
How did you end up specifically in the Marine Corps? Did all 3 of you end up in the Marine Corps?
No. My brothers were in the Army, different branches. Glenn was in Fort Bragg. Buddy was in Lafayette, down in, I think it's Indiana or Illinois somewhere, some southern state. I was in San Diego at camp at MCRD Recruit Depot. From there, I went to Camp Pendleton. But almost immediately, they started this brainwashing, I guess, because they wanted to get inside my head and control it. So after getting down there, getting my head shaved, learning that I was slimy, anything bad, that was us. I had to stand at attention for 36 hours. I did make the mistake of flinching once, and I had 3 DIs punch the hell out of me. That's when I realized that life was not the same. I was not in Kansas anymore.
Total.
I met 88 of the best guys that you never want to meet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us went through AIT, Advanced Infantry Training, together. Then we went to recon training. We were given 5 days furlough. And we all met back at El Toro Air Force Base, Marine Corps Air Force Base. And from there, we were given what was called WESPAC, our orders.
Mm-hmm.
So out of all of my buddies, Alton William Logan III was my best buddy. And the irony of it all, Alton's family had changed their name from Custer to Logan. And we had a great time together. And I lost him. I lost him. We got hit at the Da Nang Air Force Base. Bombs, bullets. We were side by side. We figured we'd go back to back. If one of us was going to go, we were both going to go. But it didn't work out that way. After the fighting was over, some 3 hours later, he was still on my back. And I thought he was okay. I stood up because we were in a crouched position, and he fell over. His head was gone. 3 days later, while we were doing cleanup, I found a bucket with milk in it and what was left of his head. Never touched milk since. When we weren't doing that, we were out in the jungle. I was a tunnel rat. And I wasn't so much scared of the guy that was in the tunnel. Not as much as I was of the snakes, the rats. Wasn't doing that, I was driving truck. We called them cattle cars. Big 18-wheelers, and we'd shove bodies in there. We called it asshole to belly button. My job was to shove as many of them in there as I could. And everything was based on lifespans. If you were a grunt, you had a 5-second lifespan. If you were motor transport like I was for that period, you had a 10-second lifespan, because everybody knows that when they see the cattle trucks, they're soldiers. Kill them. That lasted for a while. Then I was back in the jungle. Because you're First Nation, you were always, you knew you were the point man.
Really?
And we got in trouble a couple of times because a lot of the blacks, Mexicans, Indians, we kind of bunched up, and we kept running into what we call lifers, John Wayne type guys. And they were dangerous for us. So we formed what was called the Band of the Hand. We'd take a bootlace and we'd band it. And if we got in a big firefight, if you had that band on your hand, we were going to come after, we were going to back you before we backed anybody else. Of course, we lost stripes, we got fined, we were disbanded. But I considered Vietnam to be the real ugly war. That's when the war changed. Mm-hmm. People saying, you can't do this, and letting the bad guys push us. We were limited.
How?
We know what we wanted to do, but we weren't allowed to do it. Politics. Stretch it out. And we got to talking when we felt like Vietnam was just a balance of economy. That's how we felt. Mm-hmm. Get rid of a few guys and the economy will boom over the other side. That may not make sense, but you had to be there. And it's hard. It's hard to tell somebody about what it was like over there. You see kids, they brag about Rambo, they brag about all these soldiers, but they don't show the guy packing a 50-pound bucket of ammo. They don't show the guys lugging their equipment through the bush. They don't show the guys that try to take a crap and keep the rats from trying to crawl up your ass. They don't show the guys that have to sleep in the dirt. And out of 88 guys, you watch them die one by one, and sometimes like once. And Trang, when you had to sleep with them for 3 days, smell them. Watch the flies and the maggots and the rats. You start getting mean. Not because you you're mean, basically, but you just get mad. You just get mad. There's a whole bunch of us who are 17. The oldest guy in our outfit was 18. He lasted 6 months. We used to call him the grand old man because he was, we made him the boss. We stuck together. We were hungry together. We were cold together. We were wet together. We were hot together. You know, it's not like you stop the war at 5 o'clock and you go have dinner. I mean, you'd go days before you got an airdrop of boxed lunches. All a lot of us could think about is what kind of, inside there used to be a little packet, 4 cigarettes. Are we going to get our brand? Is it going to have a filter? Is it going to be a menthol? Those are things that may seem silly to others, but to guys like us, it was a reason to make it one more day. You know, we talked about cars, we talked about girls, we talked about beaches, usual stuff when we could. Then when the hand-to-hand combat would come, and that came a lot after they took our M14 rifles away. M14 rifle was an awesome rifle. Then they gave us these little Tonka toys, these M16s. The very first M16 was a piece of crap. It jammed. It jammed a lot. So what they did was they gave me a 6-pound baseball bat. That's what it was most of the time. And trying to sleep, to get comfortable, I'd stare at the stars and I'd look for something familiar. And I'd know where my mom was, where my dad was. When the stars were gone, it just seemed like, okay, I'm back in the nightmare. But you know, the funny thing is, and it scared me, you got used to it. You got used to it. Picking up that rifle and squeezing the trigger was just routine. Seeing people dead, just routine. It was like, our people call it your sili. It's like your soul was gone. And you were just what they said you were, part of a green machine. But after getting airlifted, getting stabbed in the back with a bayonet in my spine, and it still hurts, especially when it's cold, taking machete to my right side, bayonets in my wrist, having my nose crunched where I got little to drain plastic. Most guys pick the nose. I get to pick plastic. Having this part of my lip, luckily, was somewhat mended itself. That's because somebody was bashing rifles into my face. We had no more bullets. It was hand to hand. Grenades going off, getting bits of barbed wire stuck in your hand from having to wrap it around a fence. I call it shrapnel, but I used barbed wire because I had nothing else to fight with. Seeing guys take their beat-up rifles, stick their bayonets on it because we couldn't stand up, stick it in the ground and try to stick our belt on it because we wanted to go down standing. That didn't work so well because you're tired, you're losing blood, you're beat up, and you fight till you can't fight no more. After the skirmishes, and there were many, you know, you watch Once Were Warriors. That's closest. Mm-hmm. That's the closest, and same with Hamburger Hill, because the Hamburger Hill captured the insanity. Mm. You didn't know who was the good guys and bad guys, because most people didn't realize that there was more than one branch trying to go up those mountains. But when I saw Once Were Warriors, I cried. I said, yeah. That I could relate to, because that's how it was. But when they were picking me up and I asked the guy where I was going, and he said, "You're going home." I looked at him and I said, "Home? Going home." So they flew me over to Korea, patched me up in the MASH units there, sent me home because the doctor said, "You know what? We don't expect you to live. We can't take the bayonet piece out of your spine because it's perfect. We take it out, you're going to be a cripple. Leave it in for so long, it's going to rust." I kind of looked at him and I said, "I ain't going home in half a minute. Let me go this way and let me live my life as long as I could." So I was in the VA hospital. My mom came in and I didn't recognize her. 3 days. Didn't recognize nobody. And as I started coming back, and that's what I try to tell people, I was coming back to me. Mm-hmm. I was doing strange things in the hospital. They said, how did he get out of bed? I was still mad. And for some godforsaken reason, I have yet to explain all these years later, I don't know why I got out of bed after they said I was not going to be able to walk for many, many months, had to go through all this crap therapy. I walked down the hallway and unplugged a pop machine and brought it into my room. I walked to the lobby and I ripped the telephone out of the wall and I brought it to my room. I don't know why I did it. To this day, I don't know why I did it. Then when I saw my mom on the evening of the third day, I looked at her and I said, "You promised me a cheeseburger, Mom." I thought it was 1969 again, not 1973.
It's 4 years.
She went out and got me a cheeseburger. So when I went home, she said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want Dad's favorite." And Mom was crying quietly. I thought, she's just happy to see me. I'm looking at the door, waiting for my dad. So I thought, I'm going to go in Mom's room and watch TV. Because I'd found out about Buddy. I'd found out about Glenn. They were gone. They were still overseas. And I saw a flag. I said, "Mom, what's this?" She said, "Well, you know, son, the same room, the same doctor you lived in, your father died in just a few days before." And I looked at my mom and I thought, my pain is nothing. Here's a woman that watched her husband die. Here's a woman who saw her son come in. Here's a woman that was dealing with two pains without showing any. Here's a woman that sat in front of the TV and tried to get a glimpse, hoping to see one of her sons on TV at news time, just to know that they were alive. Here's a mom that said, "Bye." She's the true hero. And that's the kind of strength that kept me here now. I wanted that power she had. And just last week we were out cleaning graves and my dad's was one of them. I miss him. But the memory of him keeps me warm. It was then that I made myself a promise that I would live a clean, good life, because there's 87 guys who aren't here. They had dreams. They were human ones. So I treat everything with respect and the dignity it deserves in honor of those men. know, once a year the world says, lest we forget. But every day I say, I'll remember you boys. And one day, we'll walk again. I don't want to sound like I'm some kind of soap opera kid, but I see the good in life. Because I saw good men give up their lives for something that we thought was real. I was angry inside for a long time before I came to that conclusion because there were no parades. Veterans got off planes, trains, buses, all shut up, and nobody cared. They hated us. We were hated over there, we were hated over here. I believe the enemy we fought was ourselves. That may sound corny, but we learned something that nobody will ever be able to understand. I don't hesitate to tell you or anybody else, I'm a free man. And I lived the dream for those guys. I may not be rich, I may not have a fancy this or whatever, but I got a good smile. I got a healthy family. When I dance, I wear veterans' colors on my powwow regalia. Red, black, and white, and blue. My colors, veterans' colors. When I'm dancing, there's 87 shadows with me. I'm proud of those guys. I'm proud to be a veteran. I'm president for the Island Association, so I fight for what's rightfully theirs. You look at the guys from World War I, World War II, they're given a check for $2,000, where the non-natives got $6,000. The Indian guys were told, you go back to reserve and apply for a house. The white guys were given homes, land taken from the reserves. Every war is the same thing. They tell you we've got money for the World War II veterans that are alive. So in good faith, we sent my father's discharge papers, his war records. My mother got a letter back 2 months later saying, not enough proof. In the documents we sent, it highlighted 2 silver stars. 2 bronze stars, 2 purple hearts. Wasn't enough information, so she didn't get any of the widow's benefits. Very few men did. Very few. I think they were just a token bunch picked out of some computer. So my fight for Aboriginal veterans is far from over. I think when I think about how I feel, I take something my father said. If you do what you always done, you get what you always got. Well, I'm not going to do what I always done, because I don't want what I've always got. I want to win. I was born a winner. I want to die a winner. And if I can do anything for the Aboriginal veterans, then at least I'll be able to take that walk on the clouds and look back and see the seed that was planted. And maybe, just maybe, the human race will walk like that instead of the way it is now. I want to be the leader. I want to be the leader. Follow me. I know a shortcut. But politics has always been something that's Indian people are used to. The Italians got the mafia, we got chief and council. I mean, that's the reality. And there has to be warriors. You know, my son, 2 of my sons came forward 3 years ago. They said they wanted to join the military in Squamalt. For the first time in my life, I slapped my oldest son. And my mother got up and said, no more. Not from this family, no more. After my son saw what it was like on TV and he lost a friend, he came back to me and said, thanks, Dad, that was the kindest thing I ever did for him. But it hurt. It hurt to hit something you love. Because I'm untalented, I didn't have the words to say, don't do it. I didn't know how to do that. The only thing I could do was just slap them. I wanted to cut my hand off. Now, you saw his wife, you saw his two children. He's a rich man. And he's not scarred. He's not crying. He's not lost. I have all my children. I have my wife. But you know, Rebecca, many is the time I've wondered, how would I have been if I had not been taken into the military from 17 to, say, 21? What would my life have been like? I'll never know. And that part's missing. Sometimes I go and I sit in the cemetery and I talk to my father. It's the only place I can go. I used to sit in the closet, but people thought I was crazy because it was my sanctuary. Mm-hmm. You know, I meant it when I said I love the woods. I could run around in here for months, and you'd only find me if I wanted you to. I know what to eat. I know how to sleep, leaving little or no evidence that I was even there. I think that's why you find a lot of veterans in the mountains or in the forest. See, the forest, it kisses you. It caresses you and it holds you. Some people may not understand that comment, but then you got to be there. You had to have experienced it to know what I mean. We fought in the bush, the jungle, the swamps, the rivers, the mountains, the bare dirt. We come home and the only place we feel safe is in the woods. And that's a good thing for me. I started writing songs. Look at the treetops. Yeah, 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 yeah. You can write songs by looking at the top of a tree. That's what the forest gives me. That's my medicine. I go and I bath in the rivers and it takes everything for that moment away. Oh, I'm mad at Rebecca because... And I go in the water, 4 o'clock in the morning, and just get out. What happened? It's gone. It's gone. You take these small pines and firs, and you whip it back and let it slap your face in the morning, and it gives you strength, because the tree is saying, this is where your roots are. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting off track. I don't know what...
No.
It's just... It's just that, you know, people ask what makes me normal. I don't know what normal is. But see, I'm glad we're talking because I feel at ease here. Mm-hmm. I still get nervous in the cities. I still get jumpy when I hear horns honk. Mm-hmm. I still don't like having my back to any doorway. A lot of things. I dream a lot. The screams will never go away. But I don't bring it out and show it to my family. I don't use that as an excuse to scream at my wife. She did nothing. She stole my heart. She gave me the precious, gave me kids. So precious, it made my blood strong, watching them cry and crawl and walk and talk. Sometimes you want to kick them in the butt because they frustrate the hell out of you. But 99.9% of the time, you just look at them in awe. And I think carrying the dreams that I carry and the cries that I carry, I look at women because of my mom, because of what she went through. I tell my sons, you hold a woman in awe. It's fine to kiss. It's fine to hold hands. It's fine to do a lot of things. But she's got this miracle gift she carries inside, an expression of love, and it's called a baby. She nurtures that child, teaches that child how to walk, teaches that child how to know, yes. And then here comes me, and a million guys like me, and say, that's my son, that's my daughter, I. All of a sudden, the mom is in the background, and she's content with that. But never has a woman, any woman, all women, express love when they produce a child. That's something that's awesome. And, you know, I look at how my mom's 85 now, and she's still strong. And because of her, I learned to look at you and a million other women with, like, you know, you may not believe it, but you take away some of my pain because you're a miracle giver. I look at anything and everything and I see what is, what was, what could be. And that may come sound funny coming from a guy who's supposed to be talking about war, but all of that made the guy that you're talking to now. All of that. I don't feel that I have to get drunk. I don't feel I have to try to kill myself. I don't feel that I have to paste myself with tattoos. I don't feel that I have to be abusive, verbally or physically. Instead, I just want to be humble. I am a warrior. I am a free man. I'm a humble. I want to be a humble friend, husband, father, grandfather, uncle, cousin, what have you. And if there's anybody to read my message, it's this. If your child wants to be a warrior, talk to them. You can't just pick up a uniform and a gun and think you're all of that. It takes a certain kind of breed to do that dirty business. I fear for what's going on in Iraq because now people look at Iraq like they looked at Vietnam. Yeah. I hear the tone changing and I worry and I pray that they don't feel the contempt and the loneliness we felt when we came home. But you know, every time me and my boys marched, I mean the other veterans, the guys from World War I said, it's up to you guys, to the World War II guys, because we're going away. Now the World War II guys say to the Korean boys, it's your turn because we're going away. Charles Schleck, one of my best buddies, also a Marine from Korea, he said, it's up to you boys now, Joe, because I'm going away. He is gone, but he's here. Now I look at the Iraqi boys and because I'm getting gray hair and I'm getting whatever, I look at them and I've told them, it's up to you guys now. Somewhere, somebody's got to pick up the torch and end this nonsense. That, in a nutshell, is Joe Graythorne, United States Marine Corps. I don't know what else you want to know. I try to stay away from all the gory stuff because that's mine. Mm-hmm. You can't put it down on paper. I guess you could.
But for what use?
I wish you could see the boys that I saw. Sometimes I used to tell my brothers I felt like I got raped. Mm-hmm. I went from being this gullible, naive 17-year-old boy to this other guy who came home for a 5-day furlough, and I was convinced everybody was a slimy civilian. That's how immediate the brainwashing was over that 15 weeks or so, 8 weeks boot camp and AIT and recon training was so constant.
You mentioned before about a man you met at a garage sale.
Yeah. That's Tran. We went to a garage sale, my wife and I, not too many years ago, 3 years or so. And this guy walked over to me while I was looking at his wares, grabbed my arm, one arm on my wrist, one arm on my elbow, and I thought, what's going on here? Is this guy funny or what? And he kept saying, you remember me, you remember me. I said, no, I don't know you for nothing. Then he asked me about a place. And I said, yeah, I'd been there. I was in a foxhole for 3 days with this South Vietnamese boy. And I said, you? We couldn't talk. He spoke Vietnamese. I spoke English. I mean, we were just two guys in a hole waiting for a chance to get away. We were pinned down, we'd run out of bullets, it was raining, we had no food, we were hungry. And I asked him, because his wife said he learned English, he came, and of all places, he came to Duncan. I meet him in a yard sale, 32 years later. And I said, how do you remember me? He said, when you slept, I studied you. You were so tired you didn't feel my fingers on your face. He memorized me. And in his mind, he kept picturing me as I got older, and he walked up to me and picked me out. So whenever I get time, I go and visit him, bring him all the fish I can catch, and we eat, we talk. My wife doesn't like hearing it because we talk basic stuff. His family experienced it, so it's like waking up in a reserve. They knew what was going to happen every day. But my wife said she didn't want to hear it, and I don't blame her. Mm-hmm. But we're good friends. I see him at least every couple, 3 months. We don't spend a lot of time together because I don't want to lose that feeling. You know, they say, old people tell you if you leave a fresh piece of bread on the table overnight, it gets stale. And I don't want it to go stale. I want it to stay the way it is. I just want to live long. I want to watch all my children prosper. That's my last wish. But I'm 57 years old and my youngest child is 2, so I know I'll never see him grow up. But at night I see him. I dream. My dreams aren't as ugly as they used to be. They'll never go away. But these kids, because of my wife, because of my mom, are taking all of my hurt, and little by little, it's moving to the back burner. And that's awesome. That's a national Aboriginal dream, to have the peace that I'm coming to. For a veteran, that's the dream. You know, people look at us, you look at Ernie, you look at all the guys who've been in combat, and my sons say, Dad, as much as I'm happy, there's always a look in my face, in my eyes, that they don't understand, and I don't understand that look. Mm-hmm. I just know that sometimes I feel far, far away. But it's not as much anymore because of what I have. I don't know. I don't know what more I can tell you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I hope somebody learns from what I've said, or at least kind of understands I don't care what color you are. It doesn't hurt to say hi. Don't just look at them and walk by. Just say hi.
Thank you.